I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of the podcast What Next TBD at Slate, and I'm in for Tanzina Vega all this month. This is The Takeaway. It's good to have you with us. Our crew is mostly working from home again this week, with a couple of people in the studio helping us all get to your ears. I'm in my apartment, so if you hear sirens or birds or my dog, it is all real. And speaking of sirens, they've pretty much become the soundtrack of my neighborhood in Brooklyn, and all of New York, really, since COVID-19 made its way here and overwhelmed our hospitals. Since the outbreak began, there have been around 340,000 reported cases in the U.S. And of those cases, around 10,000 people have reportedly died as a result of the novel coronavirus. But experts agree the real numbers are likely much higher. The numbers we're hearing don't capture the full scope of the pandemic and the number of people it's affecting. So today, we're heading to the U.S. South. Though it started on the coasts, COVID-19 is engulfing the rest of the country and disproportionately striking communities of color. And the South is certainly no exception. As we reported on our show last week, COVID-19 is devastating parts of rural Georgia. Now, Louisiana is a growing hotspot, with New Orleans expected to become the next epicenter of the pandemic. According to new research, the virus is killing residents in the southeastern part of the state at higher rates than elsewhere in the country. And without the resources of major metro areas like New York City, communities in the South are at even greater risk. Especially given the inequities in the region when we're talking about public health, access to food, and infrastructure. So today on The Takeaway, we're breaking it all down for you. I'm joined by three people who know a lot about how this pandemic is unfolding in the South. Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer with The Atlantic. Dr. Rebecca Gee is the former secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health and now head of the Louisiana State University's Healthcare Services Division. And Dr. Marinel Payton is the chair and professor of epidemiology at Jackson State University's School of Public Health in Mississippi. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Van, I want to start with you because you've written quite a bit about this. How is what we're seeing in the South with the COVID-19 epidemic different than what we're seeing everywhere else in the country?
Well, I think what we're seeing, especially in the states that are reporting high numbers of deaths, so Louisiana and Georgia right now, is that a higher proportion of those deaths are in people who are not considered in the highest risk group elsewhere. So usually in other places in Colorado, in Washington, in China and Italy, it's mostly people over 70. But actually in Georgia and Louisiana, there's a much higher proportion of people under 70, folks with likely who have comorbidities. That's likely because of the health profile of the South.
Tell me about that health profile a little bit.
Well, you've got a higher proportion of the population that has underlying conditions that we know are going to lead to more likely severe complications from COVID-19. So you've got more people with hypertension, with diabetes, with heart disease, a whole raft of problems often together. But we do know there are more people at risk of worse complications in the South.
Dr. Gee, I want to bring you in here. When we talk about these health complications and existing health disparities in the region, what accounts for those?
Certainly, historical poverty. You know, Louisiana is one of three states in the nation where 40% or more of our people live below 200% of poverty. You know, issues of historical segregation, racism, and social vulnerability are higher in the Deep South, and certainly those same issues come to play here. I would say certainly in Louisiana, the majority of folks are over 70. There are smaller numbers below, but certainly if you look at the Chinese data, you know, individuals with cardiovascular disease and diabetes are at high risk. And if you look at CDC maps, whether it's the Social Vulnerability Index or its indexes of chronic disease, the Deep South and particularly Louisiana often are the heat maps of those, and all of these things interrelate.
Dr. Payton, what are you seeing in Mississippi? Does it jibe with what Dr. Gee and Van are talking about?
Yes, it does. Actually, listening to Dr. Gee completely mirrors what's going on here in the state of Mississippi. You know, the state is leading the country in health disparities, number two in diabetes, number one in heart disease. As she mentioned, cardiovascular disease puts those with COVID 19 at greater risk. And also, you have to consider things like obesity, because most of the obese here have underlying problems as well, even the younger population. So it's definitely putting a strain on the overall healthcare system. You know, already every day we have thousands of people with heart disease. We have heart attacks or stroke. Now that the hospitals have become inundated with COVID-19, my question, my concern, as a healthcare provider, is what are we going to do with our healthcare system? How are we going to treat those of us that just might have the, I'm just going to say, the usual problems?
Van, you wrote a lot in your piece, and you mentioned it just now, about younger people with severe COVID cases. Is there any other demographic information that we have so far, and we're relatively early into this, that we can tease out about who is getting sick and who is getting really sick?
We are still in the early stages of getting data from state health departments, understanding exactly what's going on. So you don't want to overinterpret. I think all we can say for sure is that right now, so far, in the states that are recording age, which not all states do, of the cases and deaths, they're just, especially among the population of people who are working age, more working age folks who appear to be dying. And that's really, I don't know how much you can tease it, the data further than that, but that's what it appears like.
Do we know anything yet about race and socioeconomic status?
There's a couple people who are pushing for those data right now. I think there was a bill introduced by Anna Pressley to direct HHS to do this. I know Michigan has released some preliminary data on that, and those preliminary data basically show or would indicate things that are consistent with this conversation. More African-American people proportionally with serious complications.
Dr. Payton, one thing that's striking is a figure that Mississippi Today reported saying your state has the highest rate of hospitalizations, roughly 31%, among people who have tested positive for COVID-19. Do you have any sense why people in Mississippi who are getting infected are being hospitalized at such high rates?
I'm assuming, you know, based on this conversation and what we've just said, that it's probably closely associated with the comorbidities, you know, given the fact that there are persons that are experiencing problems already. We know that Mississippi is sick. This is one of the sickest states in the nation. And then when you compound it with such a virus such as COVID-19, you can actually understand why there would be such high hospitalization rates.
Dr. Gee, New Orleans, we know, has become a hotspot in this pandemic. Why did the disease spread so quickly there? And I know that this is a touchy subject in Louisiana, but what role did Mardi Gras play?
We just don't know that yet. But what we do know is this was one of the largest convenings of people from all over the world in the United States at the time when we now know the virus was spreading, and before individuals at the CDC or other officials had confirmed that. And we did not have the ability to broad scale test at that time. And so there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking, blaming individuals who should not be blamed at that time. Because we had not implemented, I would say, the appropriate public health surveillance and the level of attention was not on it, we did not have population health estimates of COVID. We only knew about individuals who had travel-related COVID. And so, you know, nothing at that point was being canceled. So Mardi Gras went on, but certainly these were the perfect conditions for spread. And unfortunately, now we're paying the price.
Van, let's talk a little bit about state governments here, because so much has fallen on the shoulders of state governments, and we've seen different responses in different states. What are some of the things we are seeing, say, in Louisiana or in other states in terms of dealing with this or issuing stay-at-home orders?
Well, we've seen, like you said, a pretty wide variance. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has moved, I'd say, pretty aggressively on this front, especially in predicting how this thing was actually, it will look in weeks, and trying to encourage people to stay home. People in Louisiana at least have seen the curve and know what it looks like in April, mid-April, and people are afraid. Some other states haven't moved quite as quickly. Likely that's because there isn't as much surveillance. They don't have the type of explosion that New Orleans has had. And some people, I think, have a bit higher sense of security than they should.
Dr. Gee, I think about Louisiana, and it's a place I've reported a lot. I remember talking to people post-Hurricane Katrina who used to work at Charity Hospital, which is now closed. And I wonder what the uptick in COVID cases has meant for the hospital systems in the state.
You know, I think it's important to make sure we're looking at the right kind of data. I know you can say, well, how many percent of people who have COVID are in a hospital? That's really a better measure of how many people you're testing than how many people are sick. I think what we're really interested in is the per capita death rate, i.e. how many people are dying per population. And those numbers are startling. We have the highest by far death rate in the U.S., higher than New York. And our people are sicker. And back to your point about Mississippi, I mean, Mississippi should have done this weeks ago. We've been doing this for weeks. There are no firm borders in this nation, and we should assume that COVID is everywhere. And so the fact that we have governors who have not been as aggressive as John Bel Edwards just means that this is going to be a longer journey to get this under control, and is unfortunate. You know, we all need to think about this, I think, from the standpoint of a national response, and assume that although in New Orleans we have these numbers now, and next week it's Mississippi, and the sooner that we stay at home, the quicker we're going to save lives and reduce transmission. But just to say that these heat maps of chronic disease are also related to levels of inaction. I mean, if you look at a map of who acted quickly, you know, Washington State, Oregon, places where people generally are healthier, and the Deep South acting more slowly, you know, Governor DeSantis, you know, really, particularly with Florida and that population being so so much older and at risk, it does not bode well for us with the combination of our chronic disease, and that puts us at higher rates of death. I know in our ICU, for example, in Washington State, a report came out in the New England Journal that about 75% of their patients who needed an ICU admission had to have a ventilator. In Louisiana, at Ochsner, it's 86%. So we are sicker when we're getting it, whether we're young or we're old, because of our chronic conditions. And I think, therefore, those areas that are higher risk because of our social vulnerability or chronic disease need to act aggressively, just as Governor Edwards has, so that we can save lives and make sure to flatten this curve.
Dr. Gee, you mentioned heat maps, and Southerners are more likely to be uninsured compared to people in other parts of the U.S. Is there a similar heat map that you could apply in terms of insurance rates? And what does that mean for access to care?
Well, so the good news is that in 2016, and I served under the governor as his health secretary then, and his first act was to expand Medicaid, which I led, we were able to reduce the uninsurance rate in our state from 1 in 4 adults being uninsured to now an 8% uninsurance rate, which is lower than the national average. So the fact that our people do have primary care, they have access to, in fact, we ranked 8th in the nation on utilization of primary care last year on the BRFSS survey. So that bodes well for us in terms of individuals having the ability to get access to a doctor outside of an ER or hospital setting. That being said, health insurance doesn't undo chronic disease. And so despite the fact that we're seeing really exciting increases on cancer screening, mental health and substance use treatment, and all of those things that you can fix with health insurance, you know, our obesity rates have remained stagnant. Our heart disease rates haven't changed. Certainly our diabetes patients who need medication have more access to it, but we still have chronic disease despite the uninsurance. But I'm even more worried for places like Mississippi that don't have a Medicaid expansion.
Well, yeah, Dr. Payton, what does access to insurance and to care look like in Mississippi, particularly in the more rural parts of the state?
That's one of the greatest concerns, people who are in the rural area and, as Dr. Gee said, who do not have Medicaid expansion. It looks really dire. I think that's another problem that COVID-19 is actually bringing to states like Mississippi. People are having a very, very hard time, even without COVID-19, in reference to health insurance. A lot of people actually just don't have it. The job employment rate is like 30 times higher than it was before COVID-19, and a lot of those people are without health insurance, so things are pretty gloom.
I want to talk a little bit about infrastructure and transit in the South. Van, is it more difficult, do you think, for people to limit their movements? I think about my in-laws. They live in a, you know, pretty small city in South Georgia, and people are being told, you know, stay home, limit your movements. But how do you do that if, say, you live in a food desert or someplace where you got to drive for a while to get essential services?
Are we talking about the graphic that everybody was talking about?
Oh, yeah. Big map in the New York Times. Yeah.
Yeah. I think lots of folks just really didn't quite have a handle on what life is like, even before the age of physical distancing and lockdowns in rural areas, especially all across the country, but definitely in the South. You know, it's not just food deserts. It's how many people in this country have to travel more than 15 minutes to get a prescription? And lots of those people are in the South. So the idea that the sort of lockdowns that people are envisioning in New York City are even feasible, say in where I come from, which is Eastern North Carolina, just doesn't fly. Like, if you don't pick up toilet paper from Walmart, which is a 30-minute drive in some places away, you can't just Postmate it. it doesn't work that way. So really what we should be measuring is whether people are changing their patterns over the existing patterns. And we know that Southerners, that people in rural areas tend to drive more. They tend to drive longer distances every day. And so I think we are seeing in places outside of cities across the country that people are limiting their distance traveled compared to what they usually do. And that's a good sign that these 87-90% of Americans under lockdown orders right now are actually following them.
Dr. Payton, are you seeing that in Mississippi?
I am, yes. A lot of people are happy that the stay-at-home order was actually put in place because people are afraid, you know? And even though there are longer distances to drive to get things like groceries, at least people are doing that. And it's sad to say, but I know people are sort of, I hate to use the term, stocking up on things, at least for the next month, so that they will not have to, you know, get out.
Van, we are also talking about a population that has a higher incarceration rate than anywhere else in the country. What do we know about what this means for people in prisons and jails?
The population in prison is probably the most vulnerable to just about any, outside of nursing homes maybe, the most vulnerable to about any pandemic that could sweep this country. They live in tight quarters. The type of distancing we're recommending on a public health level is almost impossible to achieve. Baseline, you already see higher rates of comorbidities, of higher rates of infectious disease in prisons. So right now, it's just a mess. I think we already see there is one federal prison in Louisiana that's experiencing a pretty decent-sized outbreak. You see it in New York and in Rikers. Two things I think are emblematic of what we will expect to see in prisons across the country and obviously across the South, which, as you said, incarcerates more people per capita than anywhere else.
Dr. Gee, go ahead.
One thing I just wanted to highlight, and this is, a real issue of health equity, and I talked to President Veray, who's president of Xavier University, yesterday about this. We're both concerned that people who are frontline workers, those who are in prisons, those who are minimum wage workers, who are disproportionate to our region, but this is the same issue throughout the country. We're focused so much on healthcare workers having protective gear, but not for these workers. And so we've got a lot of people on the front lines working in these conditions who, you know, may not have appropriate protection. I think this is an issue that NIOSH needs to focus on, and we need workplace safety recommendations that need to be promulgated throughout the United States so that those individuals who are cashiers at grocery stores are on the front lines too, and they're very important, and we need to protect them as well. So I think we need to think about health equity and in this regard as well.
Dr. Rebecca Gee is the head of the Louisiana State University's Healthcare Services Division. Van R. Newkirk II is a staff writer with The Atlantic. And Dr. Marinel Payton is a professor of epidemiology at Jackson State University's School of Public Health. And hey, you probably have thoughts on this. If you're a listener in the South, give us your take. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, as always. And I'm Lizzie O'Leary with you all month. This is The Takeaway.